Hello, it is April 18th. I'm Lodi Evola, and I'll be reading to you today from the front pages of the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. We'll take a look before we begin our stories at the photographs on the front of both newspapers. On the front of the New York Times, the large colored main photograph, probably about a 5 by 7, is of deadly flooding. It's in the Middle East, this particular photograph of the United Arab Emirates, and it's in front of what appears to be a public building with men walking almost knee-deep in water. They had incredible flooding in one day, more rain than they usually get in a year, and they're just not situated to handle it. The next photograph is probably a 2 by 2, a small colored photograph. It's the 7 Revolutionary Guards that were killed in Iran. And it shows coffins lying end to end, covered with the Iranian, each one covered with the Iranian flag, and featuring a photograph of the dead guards, and overlooking many men, dozens of men, all with their heads bowed, some bareheaded, some with turban-style headwear. And this, as I said, is at the funeral for these men. We will have a story about that. And the last photograph on the Times shows a fighter with some piece of military hardware over his shoulder in the woods. Trees have no leaves on them, very stark, all in sepia tones. And this has to do with foreign fighters who've signed up to help Ukraine. And this must be a photograph of one of them. And then on the front of the Hartford Courant, a photograph, probably a 2 by 2, of Ellen Ash Peters, who was the Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court. She has died, and there will be a story about her when we get to the Courant. The largest photograph, again about a 5 by 7 colored photograph, shows restaurant workers being trained in how to deal with sexual harassment. This shows an instructor. This happens to be in Glastonbury. A male instructor coming up behind a woman and his student, and she's showing how to counteract certain movements. And then the last picture on the Courant, and we will have that story, shows House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's a Republican from Louisiana. He's banging down his gavel at a joint meeting of Congress. The American flag is behind him. So with that, we will go to our top story on the New York Times front page. How Israel's miscalculation poked at a hornet's nest. Israel was mere moments away from an airstrike on April 1st that killed several senior Iranian commanders at Iran's embassy complex in Syria when it told the United States what was about to happen. Israel's closest ally had just been caught off guard. Aides quickly alerted Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, John Finer, the deputy national security advisor, Brett McGurk, Mr. Biden's Middle East coordinator, and others who saw that the strike could have serious consequences, a U.S. official said. Publicly, U.S. officials voiced support for Israel, but privately they expressed anger that it would take such aggressive action against Iran without consulting Washington. The Israelis had badly miscalculated, thinking that Iran would not react strongly, according to multiple American officials who were involved in high-level discussions after the attack, a view shared by a senior Israeli official. On Saturday, Iran launched a retaliatory barrage of more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel, an unexpectedly large-scale response, if one that did minimal damage. The events made clear that the unwritten rules of engagement in the long simmering conflict between Israel and Iran have changed drastically in recent months, making it harder than ever for each side to gauge the other's intentions and reactions. Since the October 7 attack on Israel by Hamas, an Iranian ally, and Israel's subsequent bombardment of the Gaza Strip, there has been escalation after escalation and miscalculation, raising fears of a retribution cycle that could potentially become an all-out war. Even after it became clear that Iran would retaliate, U.S. and Israeli officials initially thought the scale of the response would be fairly limited, before scrambling to revise their assessment again and again. Now the focus is on what Israel will do next and how Iran might respond. "We are in a situation where basically everybody can claim victory," said Ali Vaez, the Iran director of the International Crisis Group. "Iran can say that it took revenge. Israel can say it defeated the Iranian attack. And the United States can say it successfully deterred Iran and defended Israel. But," Mr. Vaez said, "if we get into another round of tit for tat, it can easily spiral out of control, not just for Iran and Israel, but for the rest of the region and the entire world." This account of these tense weeks is gleaned from interviews with U.S. officials, as well as officials from Israel, Iran, and other Middle Eastern states. All of them spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive matters they were not publicly authorized to reveal. Senate rejects push for trial of Mayorkas. The Senate on Wednesday dismissed the impeachment case against Alejandro N. Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, voting along party lines before his trial got underway, to sweep aside two charges accusing him of failing to enforce immigration laws and breaching the public trust. By a vote of 51 to 48, with one senator voting present, the Senate ruled that the first charge was unconstitutional because it failed to meet the constitutional bar of a high crime or misdemeanor. Republicans united in opposition, except for Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the lone present vote, while Democrats were unanimously in favor. Mr. Murkowski joined her party in voting against dismissal of the second count on the same grounds. It fell along party lines on a 51-49 vote. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and the majority leader, moved to dismiss each charge, arguing that a cabinet member cannot be impeached and removed merely for carrying out the policies of the administration he serves. "To validate this gross abuse by the House would be a grave mistake and could set a dangerous precedent for the future," Mr. Schumer said. It took only about 3 hours for the Senate to dispense with the matter. Republicans, for their part, warned that the dangerous precedent was the one that Democrats set by moving to skip an impeachment trial altogether, which they argued was a shirking of the Senate's constitutional duty. They tried several times to delay the dismissal, failing on a series of party line votes. "Tabling articles of impeachment would be unprecedented in the history of the Senate. It's as simple as that," said Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader. Mr. McConnell did not mention that he voted in favor of an unsuccessful Republican effort in 2021 to dismiss a second impeachment case against former President Donald J. Trump over the January 6th attack on the Capitol before the Senate held a trial. Republican senators were outraged at Mr. Schumer's maneuvering. Some accused him of degrading the institution of the Senate and the Constitution itself. Others beat their desks as they called for a delay of the trial for 2 weeks, until next month or even until after the November election. They accused Mr. Mayorkas of lying to Congress and impeding Republican investigations. Senator Mike Lee of Utah, visibly frustrated, rushed around the chamber trying to strategize with his fellow Republicans. Colombia chief vows remedies to anti-Semitism. The president of Colombia said the university had suspended 15 students. She promised that one visiting professor will never work at Columbia again, that last in quotes. And when she was grilled over whether she would remove another professor from his leadership position, she appeared to make a decision right there on Capitol Hill. "I think I would, yes." The president, Nemat Shafik, disclosed the disciplinary details, which are usually confidential, as part of an all-out effort on Wednesday to persuade a House committee investigating Columbia that she was taking serious action to combat a wave of anti-Semitism following the Israel-Hamas war. In nearly 4 hours of testimony before the Republican-led Committee on Education and the Workforce, Dr. Shafik conceded that Columbia had initially been overwhelmed by an outbreak of campus protests. But she said its leaders now agreed that some had used anti-Semitic language and that certain contested phrases, like "from the river to the sea," might warrant discipline. "I promise you, from the messages I'm hearing from students, they are getting the message that violations of our policy will have consequences," Dr. Shafik said. Testifying alongside her, Claire Shipman, the co-chair of Columbia's Board of Trustees, made the point bluntly. "We have a moral crisis on our campus," she said. Republicans seemed skeptical, but Dr. Shafik's conciliatory tone offered the latest measure of how much universities have changed their approach toward campus protests over the last few months. Many schools were initially hesitant to take strong steps limiting freedom of expression cherished on their campuses. But with many Jewish students, faculty, and alumni raising alarms, and with the federal government investigating dozens of schools, some administrators have tried to take more assertive steps to control their campuses. With 5,000 Jewish students and an active protest movement for the Palestinian cause, Columbia has been among the most scrutinized. Jewish students have described being verbally and even physically harassed, while demonstrators have clashed with administrators over limits to where and when they can assemble. In bending toward House Republicans in Washington, Dr. Shafik may have further divided her New York City campus, where students had pitched tents and set up a Gaza Solidarity in Campus, that's in quotes, early on Wednesday. Colorado extends privacy rights to what goes on in our brains. Consumers have grown accustomed to the prospect that their personal data, such as email addresses, social contacts, browsing history, and genetic ancestry, are being collected and often resold by the apps and the digital services they use. With the advent of consumer neurotechnologies, the data being collected is becoming ever more intimate. One headband serves as a personal meditation coach by monitoring the user's brain activity. Another purports to help treat anxiety and symptoms of depression. Another reads and interprets brain signals while the user scrolls through dating apps, presumably to provide better matches. "Listen to your heart is not enough," the manufacturer says on its website. The companies behind such technologies have access to the records of the user's brain activity, the electrical signals underlying our thoughts, feelings, and intentions. On Wednesday, Governor Jared Polis of Colorado signed a bill that, for the first time in the United States, tries to ensure that such data remains truly private. The new law, which passed by a 61-1 vote in the Colorado House and a 34-0 vote in the Senate, expands the definition of sensitive data, that's in quotes, in the state's current personal privacy law to include biological and neural data generated by the brain, the spinal cord, and the network of nerves that relays messages throughout the body. Everything that we are is within our mind, said Jared Genser, general counsel and co-founder of the Neuro Rights Foundation, a science group that advocated the bill's passage. What we think and feel, and the ability to decode that from the human brain, couldn't be any more intrusive or personal to us. We are really excited to have an actual bill signed into law that will protect people's biological and neurological data, said Representative Kathy Kipp, a Democrat who introduced the bill. Senator Mark Baisley, a Republican who sponsored the bill in the upper chamber, said, "I'm feeling really good about Colorado leading the way in addressing this and to give it the due protections for people's uniqueness in their privacy." Biden will deny mining road through Alaskan wilderness. The Biden administration is expected to deny permission for a 211-mile industrial road through fragile Alaskan wilderness to a large copper deposit, handing a victory to environmentalists in an election year when the president wants to underscore his credentials as a climate leader and conservationist. The Interior Department intends to announce as early as this week that there should be no action on the federal land where the road known as the Ambler Access Project would be built, according to two people familiar with the decision, who asked not to be named because they were not authorized to discuss the decision. A formal denial of the project would come later this year, they said. The road was essential to reach what is estimated to be a $7.5 billion copper deposit buried under ecologically sensitive land. There are currently no mines in the area, and no requests for permits have been filed with the government. The road was a first step. Blocking the industrial road would be an enormous victory for opponents who have argued for years that it would threaten wildlife as well as Alaska Native tribes that rely on hunting and fishing. Environmentalists, including many young climate activists, were infuriated last year by President Biden's decision to approve Willow, an $8 billion oil drilling project on pristine federal lands in Alaska. The proposed road would be several hundred miles south of the Willow Project. The move comes as the Biden administration tries to find a balance between two different and sometimes opposing goals. Mr. Biden is intent on bolstering clean energy in the United States to fight climate change. Ambler Metals, the mining venture behind the proposed road, has said the copper it seeks is critical to make wind turbines, photovoltaic cells, and transmission lines needed for wind, solar, and other renewable energy. But the president is also determined to conserve environmentally sensitive lands and has been expanding the footprint of national monuments around the country while also blocking off some public lands from oil and gas drilling. David Krause, the interim executive director of the National Audubon Society's Alaska office, said protecting the wilderness around the Ambler area is a huge deal.